This is the Eurosnob Podcast.
All right, so we'd like to welcome everybody into another episode of the Eurosnob Podcast. My name is Ian. We're joined by a couple people today. As usual, my co-host, Alex, and we're also joined by my cousin, Sean, that, well, if you've listened to our podcast from the very start.
First of all, God bless you have.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think probably, not even my parents have listened from the very start. Sean was actually with us on our second episode ever of the Eurosnob Podcast. So, Sean, how's it going? Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. Sorry it took us so long.
That's okay. I live 80 miles apart now, so.
It's still, me and Alex live how far apart? And
yeah, good point.
It happens every couple of weeks. It's not too bad. It's the internet. It's a great new technology that's out there. So, Alex, how's it going for you, man?
Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
I'm good. Today's a great day to be an Arsenal fan. It really is. But before we dive into the good stuff, I know Alex wanted to bring everybody down and talk about that last game. So we're going to send it over to him for a little bit of unhappy talk before we get into the good stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to quote the Dark Knight and say the night is darkest just before the dawn. So that's how I'm going to look at the game yesterday against Swansea. Ian and Sean, unfortunately, you guys didn't have the misfortune of watching it. I did, and it was about as bad as you could expect. You've heard the phrase, can they do it on a cold Tuesday night in Stoke? Well, we couldn't do it on a cold Tuesday night in Swansea. So that was about as bad a performance from Arsenal as I've seen, which feels repetitive because I feel like I say that a lot, but this was actually really bad. I mean, from the very beginning, you knew the intensity wasn't there. And yes, the field was a mess with the rain. I get that, but the passing was slow. It was passive. You know, we got the first goal and then right away we conceded an equalizer when Granit Xhaka fell asleep and then watched his runner go right past him and Koscielny got beat. So it was 1-1 going into halftime. And then Petr Cech had an absolute shocker for the second goal, gave a ball away. Although I'll say 90% of the blame was on him. 10% was probably on Mustafi and Monreal for putting him in a bad spot. But an errant clearance went right to a Swansea player who put it away 2-1. Swansea got another one late to make it 3-1. I guess the only bright spot was that Henrik Mkhitaryan made his Arsenal debut. He had a few nice touches on the ball, got into some good positions. But overall, it was a complete mess. It was everything that Arsenal gets criticized for kind of reared its head in this instance with the timid approach and the lack of ability to kind of fight back once things got tough, and really only Ozil and Monreal could hold their head up high in that game. The rest of it was kind of a mess, but so the atmosphere around the club was definitely a mess after the game yesterday. I don't want to get too much into it because I think, you know, we kind of want to focus on the transfers today and the good news and hopefully the positive future for Arsenal. But certainly what happened yesterday made what happened today a little bit more rewarding, I would say, wouldn't you?
I don't know if necessarily rewarding, but it sure as hell showed that we needed to do something. So I guess in a way rewarding, yes. I'll give that one to you.
Yeah, maybe not rewarding, but it was needed. I'll say it was needed at this
point.
That's fair.
I couldn't think of a better word, so I just went with yours.
Yeah, no, I'd say the entire club and the fan base needed it. I don't know. Sean, what do you think on that one?
I think we needed to kind of like shake off that same old Arsenal dirt that seems to follow us during these transfer times. That, they were going after this big name striker and we actually pulled it off. It's very refreshing.
I think the crazy thing about all of this is when you look at, and it's not necessarily even just us, but the Premier League as a whole, the big names that moved in and out, this did not feel like a normal January transfer window. And this was crazy. This was a at least with us, we saw more turnover in the last 2 weeks than we've seen in what, the last two summers combined.
Certainly with our club, yeah. But just, yeah, like you said, looking around the Premier League, a lot of big names moved. You know, you're not just talking about Aubameyang, Mkhitaryan, Alexis, Giroud. You know, other clubs signed some pretty good players as well. Obviously, Man City with Laporte and who's the other one that I'm just blanking on right now?
Well, Lucas Moura came into Tottenham. Oh, yeah,
Lucas Moura came into Tottenham. I mean, obviously, we're going to kind of get into who won the transfer window, quote unquote, but a lot of movement. And I wonder why that is. I don't know if it's just that a lot of contracts are running down or a lot of teams are desperate to make top four. You know, so I'm curious to hear the rationale, but at least from an Arsenal perspective, you know, the incomings were Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang today, obviously Henrik Mkhitaryan last week, and then Konstantinos Mavropanos at the beginning of the month. But I'm actually curious, you know, because Aubameyang was the most recent one, when you guys heard this rumor first floated around by some relatively reputable journalists, what was your initial thought? Were you guys thinking, well, no, that's not going to happen, we have Lacazette, or well, that's not going to happen because, you know, of his age or because of this and that? Or were you guys thinking, all right, there's a legit possibility this happens? And when did that switch kind of flip in your minds? Sean, I'll start with you on that one.
It was floated out. It was like one of those rumors. And then I'm like, oh, okay, cool. This is, you know, this guy is playing in Dortmund. He's had a wonderful career in Dortmund so far. And, you know, I was thinking this could be just, you know, smoke, but where's the fire? And then now that we have our new scouting director, Midland Tet, is that how you say his name? I'm sorry if I butchered it.
Better effort than I gave it last time. So.
And, you know, you've got this guy who has connections to Dortmund now, and he's, you know, kind of leading the way in this like transfer window, at least with what we've been told, especially by Ornstein, is that he's played a lot bigger part during this this window than Wenger has had help, you know, for a while now. So like this started to kick up, and then I'm thinking the more the rumor hung around, the more I'm like, oh, this might actually happen. This might actually happen. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it felt like just a typical Arsenal rumor, right? I mean, we're always linked with these big names, and it always, at the end of the window, comes out that, oh, we fell short, or we didn't feel like paying up. I mean, look at the Luis Suarez transfer saga that happened when he moved to Barcelona. I mean, we're always linked with big names in every single window. And I think a lot of that is, like I've said so many times on this podcast before, that journalists and, well, finger air quote, journalists know how to drive traffic and clicks to their articles. If they put Arsenal in the headline, they're going to get a ton of clicks. So I think that plays a big part into why we get linked with so many people. So for me, the Aubameyang thing was really, I don't think I took it seriously until Ornstein said something about it. I don't remember when it was that he first mentioned it, but it all just seemed like Alex, like you said, we already have Lacazette. He's 28 years old. It doesn't fit what we normally would do. So for me to take it overly seriously, it was, I don't know, I just kind of thought it was, here we go. It's journalists winding us up again to try and get a reaction and try and turn us even more against our club.
Well, the same thing was in there, just like, sorry to interject, but like it still had that sense of like, oh, Arsenal's going to screw this up. Like Arsenal's not going to want to pay up. When they said, oh, two bids were rejected. So we're like, okay, this is kind of following the same line of Arsenal's not going to front the money that Dortmund wants for this player. So it kind of was steering in that direction still. So we were very surprised, at least by the end of the weekend, when Ornstein came out with that wonderful tweet.
Yeah, it was interesting because my initial thought when this summer, I'm sorry, when this January started, the January window, I thought we would go for younger players. I thought we would kind of start loading up on younger players and kind of build to the future, you know, with Miss Lintott coming in and Raul, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his last name, but the new director of football, basically. I thought that was kind of the direction we would start going, which is why names like Malcolm or Christian Pavone made a lot of sense. Young, dynamic attacking players. And I knew we were losing Alexis. I think that seemed like a foregone conclusion for a while. But I figured, okay, we get Mkhitaryan at least, and then we kind of survive and go to the summer. But the Aubameyang signing almost felt like a signing of opportunity rather than planning. It felt like they saw his situation at Dortmund, that he was kind of unhappy there, that he wanted to change. Obviously, you know, people might say, oh, well, it's not like he has any better chance of winning the league at Arsenal. You know, that may be true, but I think it gets frustrating for a player at a club like Dortmund to know that Bayern is always going to win the title, no matter what you do. And, you know, a player like that, probably on his last big contract, you know, really wants to finish his career with a bang. And so, you know, I heard the whispers, but I saw his valuation was initially at 70 million, I think you mentioned, Ian, or something like that. So I thought, you know what, that's a little out of our price range. We already spent that much, like I said, on Lacazette. It's not us. And I kept thinking about the formational things, but then more and more people started talking about it. And obviously once the Ornicle mentioned it, then you knew it was a legitimate possibility. And then obviously, you know, with Mkhitaryan, you had the whole, the whole video thing where they were basically showing his behind the scenes on the first day of his first day at Arsenal, and they showed him basically pointing at the camera and saying something, and some genius on Twitter, and I'm not using genius facetiously, some genius on Twitter actually amplified that noise and heard him say, "Yo, Pierre,
wanna come out here
and I don't know who I was talking to about it, might have been you guys, honestly, and we were trying to convince ourselves that okay, maybe this is what we actually heard. But it still seemed really ridiculous at the time, you know, the fact that we would have a player introduce another player, especially the likes of Aubameyang. So it all kind of seemed surreal. And then, you know, the weekend came around, still nothing was happening. There was the musical chairs with Batshuayi needing to go to Dortmund and then Giroud needing to go to Chelsea. Or Giroud was originally supposed to go to Dortmund, but then Chelsea came in for Giroud. So it felt like there were a lot of moving pieces that needed to happen. And it all seemed to come together kind of starting on Monday. And then, you know, by yesterday evening, we had the other issue with the Arsenal website releasing the video of Arsene Wenger's interview, basically confirming that we'd signed him. I don't know how they'd done that. So that's, you know, that's potentially two faux pas by the Arsenal social media, unless you want to believe that the Yo Pierre was intentional. I'm not so sure. But at the end of it, we come out with a world-class striker. Yes, he's 28, but I mean, this is a guy that all of us have seen in the Champions League against some of the best competition in the world, shining, you know, scoring goals against Real Madrid. He's scored against Bayern. He's scored against all these clubs. And I mean, it's just such a huge injection of energy and enthusiasm into the club at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of crazy that, like you said, that it actually got across the line. I mean, we're so accustomed as Arsenal fans to see our club linked with everybody. So it's shocking that we actually got it done.
I admit I was a little afraid when we found that it kind of seemed like Chelsea were holding the cards. You know, yeah, going into the beginning of this week, that, oh my God, like Batshuayi's move to Dortmund depends on if Chelsea is happy with getting a striker in return. And we're like, well, you know, that apparently the initial bid that we wanted for Giroud was too high. And then I'm like, oh no, this is going to fall through, isn't it? And luckily, it felt like, you know, I guess we kept tracking over the last couple of days and the wheels just kept turning. They didn't really stop. And, you know, he was on a plane. And of course, Arsenal Twitter had to follow his plane. So, you know, we can,
which, by the way, was awesome. That was awesome.
The funny thing that I saw going around today too, was after the Aubameyang deal was announced, and the Giroud deal was yet to be announced going to Chelsea, obviously. You saw the Never Forget Demba Ba hashtag popping up and saying, how great would that be if Arsenal said, you know what, Chelsea, fuck you, we're keeping him. After the Batshuayi deal was locked in, after the Aubameyang deal was locked in, I would have absolutely loved it if Arsene Wenger just said, nah, we'll keep him. But I think, you know, maybe if that was going to United, just to kind of get one in at Mourinho, I could see Arsene doing that. But I was hoping that something would happen and that Giroud deal would just kind of fall through for Chelsea. But
I mean, that would have been funny. That would have been
banter,
That would have been absolute banter for once that we weren't at the receiving end of, you know what I mean?
I was surprised that Giroud was still with the team in Swansea. Like, I heard reports of, like, he possibly left the hotel and it was on his way back to London. And I know that's probably just, you know, people on Twitter loving to kick up the dirt on the rumors and things like that. But
yeah, it is interesting, kind of around transfer season, when people know something might be happening, they're going to put some rumor out there that makes that seem like almost inevitable. You know, the same thing with Alexis leaving the hotel at a certain time to go to Manchester, or, you know, just various things like that. But it is kind of hard to see, you know, the end of the tunnel when you're in there, just with in terms of what's reliable and what's not. But, you know, I think at the beginning of the window, it seemed like, I don't know, it was very weird because, you know, we were in this state of limbo where we weren't sure what Ozil was going to do. Yes, we signed this young Greek defender, but there was this fear that we were just going to sell Alexis for money. And all it seemed like we'd get for him was about like 20, 25 million. Mm-hmm. That everyone felt like we weren't going to reinvest in the squad. So to come out of this with Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan, I think's about as good as any Arsenal fan could have hoped for, realistically speaking. I mean, what would you say, Ian?
Well, and I'm pretty sure that if I saw it right, the wages that Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan are on combined come into roughly about what Sanchez was asking for here. Was asking for to stay. So if you're getting both of those players and you're getting them in at the wages, even if it's a little bit more than when Alexis, what it would have cost to keep him. I mean, I'll take Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang all day over Alexis.
Yes, I know.
I mean, look at what Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang did when they were at Dortmund. I mean, that connection was better than the connection you saw between Royce and Aubameyang when Royce could stay on the field, you know, and they were, you know, Batman and Robin over there. So, I mean, for me, it's, you know, it obviously it has that Dortmund feel to it. You know, one of the things that I've said for a long time now is that I wish Arsenal handled their transfers more like Dortmund. I don't think this is handling transfers like Dortmund, but it certainly has that feel to it. I mean, one of the interesting things that, you know, we touched on it before this happened, but I'd like to get, you know, your thoughts on it, Sean. Do you think that this Aubameyang signing, and I'm not going to include Mkhitaryan in it as much because it was the swap for Alexis, but do you think the Aubameyang signing is kind of what Alex said, is that it's more of a signing of opportunity, or is it more of a shift in the kind of transfers we might see Arsenal make?
It's tough because I guess, I mean, I've heard some people say that, well, maybe this is a panic buy. I mean, Lacazette this season hasn't performed up to at least what we had hoped yet. And maybe there's just some learning that has to come from the team. But there, I mean, obviously look at the changeover we've had. Walcott's gone, Giroud's gone, Alexis is gone. We're bringing in new faces. They got to learn like how to play with each other. Obviously, we gain that advantage of like Mkhitaryan having experience playing with Aubameyang. So this could turn out to be very like a very good addition in that sense. I mean, this also could stem from maybe like a slow transition from Arsene Wenger. Maybe this isn't necessarily too much of an Arsene Wenger buy as it is, you know, Ivan Gazidis and Mislin Tat. You know, this could be them preparing for a future without Arsene Wenger, looking how they want to build the team, bring back in those, you know, really talented players. And they saw an advantage of, you know, taking advantage of Dortmund at a time where they had a striker that was available, and they went in for him and they got him. And to my surprise, it was like they kind of went in alone and expected maybe other competition to go in at the same time. And it just, I guess Arsenal was prepped at the perfect moment to go in for him. Maybe if this happens in the summertime, maybe another, you know, team tries to battle with Arsenal in a bidding war for him or something like that. But
yeah, I mean, you would have never really pegged Arsenal to go for this type of signing. And, you know, it's interesting what you were saying about it maybe not being a Wenger signing. I mean, I think Wenger still probably has quite a bit of say in in the purchases, but I mean, I think I would agree that, you know, Mislin Tat probably brought this to the table and said, look, you know, I have a relationship with this player. I know what he can do. Arsene, what do you think? I mean, and Arsene's probably thinking, oh, well, I mean, this guy's a world-class striker. I mean, I'd love to have him. And then Gazidis is probably, you know, probably came in and said, all right, you know, well, this is a guy that can help us in the immediate, but also, like you said, for the next few years, because I think that's a good point you bring up about the transition, because, and I've said this on here before, I think my gut feeling is that Arsene Wenger leaves this summer, and I think the steps that we've seen put in place and the, you know, the different organizational and structural changes lead me to think that, you know, with Mislin Tat coming in earlier this year, then Raul Snellahi or
we really
whatever.
Gotta figure out
there's gotta be a way to figure this out. But I know his first day is technically tomorrow. So all these pieces are going to be in place for the summer. And you just feel like, all right, well, now we have the structure in place. The one thing that I think 95% of us believe at this point is that the manager needs to change. And what better time, you know, potentially after the World Cup, where there's going to be a lot of good managers available, plus a lot of good club managers. And, you know, we potentially have to address all these other positions in the summer with transfers. So, you know, why not get the structure into place so that, you know, once we get a new manager, we can kind of roll on from there.
Mm-hmm. For me, you know, I don't necessarily think that the transfers in signal a shift. I know that's how I presented the question. I think the bigger shift, the thing that shows the bigger shift to me is the players that we moved out this window, and we'll get into them in just a little bit. But the point you make, Alex, about getting the infrastructure in place for life after Arsene Wenger, you know, I'm really curious to see, is it this summer or is it next summer? I mean, what is, has Arsene Wenger been the problem all along and not Ivan Gazidis? I mean, we've always... How long have we put the blame on Gazidis and the board and not Wenger?
And to that point, I mean, it makes you think with, I mean, Gazidis is clearly the one instituting a lot of these changes. I don't think there's any debating that at this point. I don't think Arsene Wenger would have brought in Mislin Tat or Snellahi. It's pretty clear that this is a Gazidis move. And there's been a lot of whispers and, you know, who knows how much truth there is that Gazidis wasn't necessarily in favor of Wenger getting to renew his contract last summer. And so I think it's not a power grab, because I think Gazidis is a good person. I don't think he's trying to screw over Arsene Wenger, but I think he is basically planning for the future. I think he's a smart guy, and we haven't given him credit for that, to be honest, myself included. I certainly, you know, when transfers didn't go our way in previous years, I thought, oh God, Gazidis fucked up another one, you know, but maybe this is just a logical succession plan coming into place, and And we're kind of seeing the fruits of that now. You know, I don't, you know, later on we can kind of get into where we think things are going to go in the summer, not just in terms of strategy, but just in terms of a manager. But I don't think you can see what's happened this January and not think that something bigger is at play here in terms of the future of the club.
Right. And I think, yeah, like I kind of touched on, we can shift to this, the players that were moved out in this window, and I'm going to list off, you know, there's three major players that we sold for, but I'm talking other than Alexis. There's three names here, and I want you guys, you know, I'll ask you first, Sean, and then Alex, what is the one thing that these three players have in common? And see if you're thinking along the same lines as me. First player, Francis Coquelin. Second player, Theo Walcott. Third player, Olivier Giroud. What do all three of these players have in common? Not necessarily them in particular, but those players at Arsenal.
They've been, I think, like the identity of Arsenal for quite some time. They've been, you know, Coquelin, Walcott's been, you know, coming up through the academy. Olivier Giroud back in, what, 2012?
He's been here a while. Yeah.
Yeah, he's been here a while. It's just, you see those old videos of him. Yeah, so that, I guess that's what I think. I'd have to agree with AJ on seeing a shift, like Arsenal's kind of like redefining itself now. Yeah. Possibly, you know, this, you know, kind of like moving towards life without Wenger, whether they have to be thinking about that at some point. This Wenger's not going to live forever. And, you know, the man's probably going to want
to. You could go with he's not going to manage forever. You got to go right to the life and death thing.
That's sorry, not trying to be dramatic.
That's all right. Alex, but, Sean, on those three players, is there one thing that kind of sticks out that those guys have in common? It's okay if you don't know. I'm going to say it, and you're both going to say, you know what? That makes – I know exactly what you're saying.
I don't necessarily know if I could narrow down to one thing. I mean, just from my perspective, these are guys that have kind of been mainstays at the club for a long time. And, you know, they've kind of – I mean – they've been good, but not great. These are players with not a lot of upside, honestly. And you know what you're getting with them, but they weren't players that were going to take you to the next level. And they're kind of limited. I don't want to say limited technically, because Giroud is a very good technical player, but
Coquelin and Walcott are certainly limited technically.
Coquelin's just limited, period. But with those three, I don't know, they kind of represented this whole era for Arsenal, which was good, not great.
Well, for me, they are Arsene Wenger favorites. They are his, you know, what the heck do you call them? Whatever, like, you know, teacher's favorite. They're
teacher's pet.
Thank you. Yes.
Doug Whaley picks.
Right. Those were his guys that, regardless of the situation, Theo Walcott, I mean, this, you kind of saw it change a little bit in this season as well, though. It's not like all of a sudden this window, they were just gone. But up until this season, those three were probably his first three names on the team sheet. When you really think about it, Coquelin always played. We said, why is he playing? Giroud always played. Yes, maybe there wasn't a better option. I mean, there certainly wasn't at the time. But the fact that we didn't bring in a better option. Nothing against Giroud, because I think he was excellent for what he did. And Theo Walcott, I mean, how many times did we sit there and scream because Theo is Theo? I mean, sure, he'd show up and score some great goals, but that's about it. All three of those players were guys that, you know, maybe I'll put it a different way. There are three guys that Arsene Wenger trusted, it seemed.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three players that, to me, I had a hard time ever seeing him selling.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, actually. I mean, I guess I never really thought of it as his favorites, but these were guys that he implicitly trusted. I think that's for sure. And especially with Theo. I mean, Theo's been at the club for what, 10 years? Something like that, since he was 16. Yeah. I don't know how old he is now. No, 16. Yeah, because he was really young when they got him from Southampton. He was a teenager. I mean,
12 years.
Oh, yeah, 12 years. So I was like, I don't think he was 12 years old. No, 16 when he got it. No, so, yeah, I mean, a guy like that or Giroud, who, like you said, has started a lot of games where we were thinking, oh, boy, why is Giroud starting here? You know, so maybe a lot of these decisions were kind of not forced on him, because I, you know, he's still the manager and I'm sure he still has a lot to say, but basically with a bigger long-term picture in mind, thinking, hey, we, you know, we need to clear out a lot of these guys who are not necessarily contributing at the level that we need to, if we want to take this next step to a big, you know, to becoming one of the biggest clubs in Europe. And we're one of the bigger clubs in Europe, but we're kind of in that second tier. You know, we're not where the Manchester United's and the Barcelona's, Real Madrid's, Bayern's, even PSG to some extent, although, you know, PSG is kind of between tier one and two. Well,
strictly because of their money. That.
Yeah, but, mm-hmm. but, you know, I mean, money is money, you know, like if you have it, you may as well use it, right? So we're trying to make that step. And candidly, those three players just weren't at the standard that you need to be an elite club. I mean, of the three, mm-hmm. Sean, I throw this one to you. Of the three, who do you think Arsenal ends up missing the most, both this season and just moving forward in the future?
I want to say Giroud definitely contributed a lot to this club, and maybe just for like this season, considering our options with, I think, like, our new signing, Aubameyang, can't play, right? And he can't play in the Euro League.
That's correct.
Yeah, he can't play in the Europa League.
Because of the, you know, Dortmund being in that league as well. So he's, like, club-tied.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
Giroud definitely, I mean, he was an asset nowadays that came into play. He didn't get that much playing time with us, but, man, when he'd come in at, like, what? 60-plus minutes, 70-plus minute, you know, he was giving his all, and he was just a dangerous threat that could end up swinging a game for us and has done so in the past.
I mean, absolutely. I can't disagree with you there. I mean, let's look at the impact that he's had in really it's a limited role, like you said, Sean. Without the impact that he's made this season, we'd be in a lot worse shape than we are. Mm-hmm. That's really saying something. So I think he's going to be missed the most easily out of that group of three. But it's one of those dilemmas, right? One of the things that I started seeing a lot of when Giroud started being rumored as part of the Aubameyang deal as part of a swap. Oh, well, what about our plan B? What about our plan B? What are we going to do? Well, let's get plan A sorted first. Our plan A isn't good enough. So before we worry about plan B, let's get A figured out and get plan A to a point where most days we really don't need plan B. So yeah, he's definitely going to be the most missed. He did provide a different element that we didn't have. And our, you know, the attractiveness of our squad really takes a big hit with him being shifted out. But like I said to our friend Bill earlier today on Twitter, I'm sure we can find a new center striker that can bang in goals. That's a little bit younger, but sure as hell isn't going to be as good looking as Giroud.
Yeah, no one's going to be as good looking as Giroud. Let's be honest. I mean, I said this on Twitter. Our status as Handsome FC took a huge blow. I mean, this
was
is
it. Rob came out with Bald FC.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. No. Buddy Rob said Bald FC. Now with Gazidis taking charge, and you know, you brought up the thing about the plan A, plan B in it, and I think that's a good thing to discuss, because the idea that you necessarily need a plan B that is completely different to your plan A, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about it. Like Calvin, one of our, you know, friend of the show that's been on before, he brought this point up to me, and actually it was kind of an interesting one. He said that, you know, for a plan, if our plan B requires everything else in the team to change, basically. All of a sudden, everyone has to start throwing crosses into the box. Basically, our focus becomes just putting the ball out wide and crossing it in. And that's, our personnel is not really suited to that. So everything about the team has to change to accommodate this one player, our so-called plan B. Why not have a plan A, but then also have options where you can change that plan A slightly? You know, that's where the flexibility of having Aubameyang and Lacazette works out. You know, you can play Aubameyang as a sole striker in, you know, a 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, and then you can still play Lacazette in that position as well, and you're not changing how you play. You still are trying to get, you know, move the ball quickly and then make those runs behind. You're not all of a sudden putting crosses into the box, or you can play those two at the same time. So you're not necessarily altering the way you play now to suit one player. And it was a great point he made up that that plan B shouldn't be such a significant deviation from plan A. You know, Arsenal is not all of a sudden a set piece team just because we have Giroud. So we shouldn't necessarily change everything to accommodate that. And Ian, kind of going back to your point about favorites, you know, If you have a guy like Giroud even available, you always felt that Arsene Wenger would be tempted to pick him, you know, just for that reason, or Coquelin or Walcott. You know, if you have those guys available, Wenger's natural tendency is to pick those guys. So, you know, maybe not having him available, it kind of forces Wenger to adapt a little bit. I mean, I don't know if he's really adapting this much, candidly, at this stage in his career, but it'll be curious to see how these guys are kind of integrated into the squad moving forward. I know there's kind of some debate on Twitter about tactically how you line up with these guys. Formationally, do you play Aubameyang and Lacazette together? Can you play them together in a 4-4-2 given our midfield or lack thereof?
Yes.
I can only hope so.
So that's a good point, and I do want to get into that. But before we go any further, I mean, we've been on for about a half hour already, half hour, maybe a little bit more. And there's probably the biggest piece of news that happened today, that came out today, hasn't even been mentioned yet. Maybe mentioned once, just kind of in passing. But the best number 10 in the entire world signed a contract extension.
Jack Wilshere?
You just sent Twitter into meltdown.
He sent Calvin into a meltdown.
Right? Oh, God. Calvin's favorite player is Jack Wilshere.
No, Sean, not Jack Wilshere.
No.
He won and only Mesut Ozil.
The magic
number. For me, the most exciting and best news of the entire day was completely overshadowed by Aubameyang signing, but I think that's by far the more significant piece of news that came down today.
Did it overshadow? I mean, was it overshadowed by Aubameyang, though? I feel like it was the reverse. I feel like the Aubameyang news came out, and then the Ozil thing came out, and that's when Twitter just exploded.
Maybe it's just because I was busy and wasn't on Twitter too much after Ozil came out, but from where I was sitting, it seemed like there was so much hype about Aubameyang, and maybe it was because there was so much buildup to it. And because we've been talking about it for weeks now, and then Ozil is just kind of out of nowhere, bombshell, signed. So,
well, maybe, It was funny because, and I'm not going on a tangent here, but it was just funny because I go to a boxing class at 6 a.m., right? And I figured between 6 and 7 a.m. our time, nothing's going to happen. I'm not going to miss any news. So naturally, I come back home and I'm like making breakfast. And all of a sudden, I flip on Twitter and it says, Aubameyang is signed. Oh, by the way, Ozil's also signed his extension in the period of about an hour. And it was just crazy how the entire future of the club and the entire direction of the club was altered in 1 hour. But I felt like I saw more reaction to the Ozil extension. I don't know. What about you, Sean? What was kind of your gut feeling about what gained the bigger reaction?
I'd have to say the Ozil extension. it's just, I think we've been building up to this Aubameyang signing for over a week now, and it's pretty much been a done deal from the last like couple days, with us tracking his flight and everything, and arriving in London, going for the medical and all that and stuff. So like, getting sideswiped by Ozil signing an extension was like, what? Like, is this literally happening right now? Like, Arsenal, you have won the day. You have totally won the day, because that was just, you know, and the perfect tweet by Mesut himself in there is like, oh, I've been doing a lot of signings today. And he's like showing him signing autographs, wink, wink. And just, it's just fantastic.
Ultimate trolling, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, either way, regardless of who's got the bigger Twitter explosion, yeah. Like I said, maybe it was just the timing that I was able to be on Twitter today.
I know Arsenal Twitter itself has been, you know, showboating Aubameyang with all the videos and the full like, yo Pierre, you want to come here video, and they've been showing all the different shoots, yeah, photo shoots that have been going on. And well, so like part of that one was like a nice little slide in there.
And part of that, and we've talked about it before, is, you know, in relation to the difference between Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez is kind of just their, not necessarily character, but persona, their demeanor. I mean, Aubameyang is such a marketable player. He's such a, he's got such a character. Mm-hmm. He's very in the spotlight. He's, you know, shows his emotion. He's flashy, and like, he's a very marketable player. Mesut Ozil's a lot more subdued, a lot quieter, a lot more, hey, mm-hmm, look, here's a picture of me in my mirror.
Yeah.
Hey, look, it's my new Mercedes. Like,
look, yeah, it says
MO10 on my wall. Like,
yeah, Obama, he comes out like kind of like Arsenal's, quote unquote, that's not a direct comparison, but like Arsenal's Pogba. This is a guy that you can, you know, you're thrown into commercials. You know, he's going to be wearing number 14. You know, he's just definitely like the poster child now. Where, like you said, Mesut is more of like behind the scenes, you know, great contributor to the club.
I do like that contrast in personality, though. Like, I feel like Aubameyang has such an innate charisma, and he speaks English too, which is great. I think that's going to only enhance his standing in the English game, and kind of as he gets integrated into the squad, the club, and it's, you know, the history of the club and kind of the atmosphere around it. I think the club needs that. I think the club needs that charismatic figure to rally around to complement Ozil, who, like you guys said, is more, you know, more subdued, more quiet, goes about his business. I mean, first of all, the dude's living life. He's got a gorgeous fiance, and you know, living, he's obviously very settled in London. And I think Aubameyang coming in is just, it's such a stark contrast to Alexis, who was just a weird dog dude. but that's what Alexis was. He was a weird dog dude with abs who trained, you know, who liked to show off and train hard and run around a lot.
He was like a crazy cat lady that just happened to be really good at football.
Yeah, exactly. He was, so instead of crazy cat lady, he was like the, what, you know, I was trying to do some alliteration with dog. It didn't happen for me there, but I tried. I mean, he literally just was this weird guy that never really fit into the squad. And this isn't sour grapes, first of all, because he's an amazing footballer, provided, mm-hmm, Arsenal tons of fantastic moments, helped us win trophies, but he just never felt like he was one of the guys. And there's so many rumors about him not getting along with guys in the squad, you know, whether it was Ramsey or Koscielny. You saw him go off on Bellerin quite a bit. So I always felt like that attitude rubbed people the wrong way, and that he kind of went into business for himself. And I just feel like Aubameyang is going to integrate into the squad a lot better. Obviously, he's already friends with Mkhitaryan. I really hope he pulls out the Batman mask. I mean, that's just if that doesn't happen, this whole transfer wasn't worth it, quite honestly.
Oh, it's a him and Royce thing though.
So we have to sign Royce then. That's
hey man, if you can fix his ankles and keep him healthy, you could sign him today. Whatever. I would be so happy with that, but the poor guy can't stay healthy.
But in all seriousness, like I'm curious to see how he does link up with these other guys, because we don't exactly play the way Dortmund does. You know, Dortmund play a little bit of more of a high press, high tempo style, and we don't really play a style anymore. We kind of wing it, I feel. So I'm curious to see how he fits into that.
The interesting thing for me, and you saw some stats kind of going around Twitter when all the Aubameyang stuff started popping up, is, you know, and they used Lacazette and Ramsey when they played together to show how much more effective Lacazette was when he had a partner that would get in behind and help create some space for him. And that's one of the things that I guess I didn't really expect of Lacazette when he came in. I thought he was more of a player that would get in behind, but he's really not. I mean, he's a player that likes to play with the last defender and drop back and kind of connect, but he's not the type of player like Aubameyang. Aubameyang's made his living getting in behind. The timing of his runs, the placement of his runs are just absolutely spectacular. Lacazette is an incredibly intelligent player, but he doesn't necessarily look to get in behind all that often. So as far as a style, I mean, when you look at Mesut Ozil and Henrik Mkhitaryan behind Aubameyang and Lacazette, just give the four of them the ball and everybody else play defense.
Well, that would be great if we could defend, though.
Right. Yeah. So let's just push everybody forward and win games 5-3. But my point is
Liverpool tries to do.
Your point is well taken though, Alex. Just about how the stylistic difference between us and Dortmund, where that fits. It kind of lends them to almost a counterattack style of game, and that does fit Aubameyang well because it does give him space to get in behind. But one of the things that I really like about Lacazette is he does a great job with his movement along the back line and drawing center backs with him as he checks back towards the midfield. So when you have a player like Aubameyang that's going to get in behind, that's going to put that center back in such a position where, you know, do I go with Lacazette and potentially leave space for Aubameyang in behind, or do I stay back? But then that allows Lacazette to, you know, and we've seen him already do it since he's been with the club, receive the ball, turn, and unleash a cannon. So just that additional threat of Aubameyang getting in behind is going to open so much more up for Lacazette. Now, we did kind of talk about, you know, briefly mention how are we going to fit all of these players, these attacking players, into one team. You know, Mesut Ozil, Henrik Mkhitaryan, both of them can kind of play wide, but we don't necessarily want to see them wide. They're better more centrally. I don't think there's really any denying that. Mkhitaryan's slightly more suited to being out wide than Ozil, but it's going to be an interesting thing to see what Arsene Wenger does with it. And I don't know, Alex, I'm going to send it to you first. Do you have any ideas as to, not necessarily what we should do, but how do you think Arsene's going to try and fit these guys in the same team?
I, my gut feeling is that one of these guys gets shifted out wide. One of Aubameyang and Lacazette. My gut tells me Lacazette gets pushed to the left a little bit, which I don't love, first of all. I'm just predicting what Arsene would do. What I think may work about that is that Alexis played wide left a lot, but he spent a lot of time in the box still, just because of the amount of possession we had. Obviously, Lacazette's not as good a dribbler as Alexis, and you don't want him taking players on one-on-one. So, you know, that's what I think will happen, and that kind of sucks for Lacazette because I think that limits his game. What I've seen rumored is maybe like a you know, kind of a 4-2-2-2. So you've got your two central midfielders who basically just hold, honestly. You don't really push forward. Then you have Ozil and Mkhitaryan playing a little more centrally, but right behind the strikers. And then you have that duo up top of Aubameyang and Lacazette. I think you need to figure out a way to play them together. I don't think you can have these two dynamic strikers and not play them together. And I don't think you limit them by putting them out wide, where you're not going to get the best out of them. So, you know, in that scenario, yeah, you do need your central midfielders to be a lot more disciplined, which is why, you know, you could potentially see Xhaka and Elneny being the guys who play there just because they sit a little deeper. It might not be great for Ramsey, to be quite honest. You might even see Wilshire step in there with Xhaka. Not the most mobile midfield, but
yeah,
that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned this previously, but I could see a scenario where maybe it plays like a 4-4-2 where Ozil on the right, Mkhitaryan on the left, and they're both kind of cutting in on their stronger foot. So they're still sort of tucking into midfield, so it kind of has the same base effect as a 4-2-2-2. I don't think you can necessarily bench Lacazette at this point. I just think that completely ruins the guy's confidence. And yes, you know, he's going to be our starter in the Europa League games because Aubameyang is not eligible. But I don't think you bring in a player for what, 60 million or whatever we paid for him, and then shift him off to the bench after one, you know, a little more than half the season. But I tend to think Lacazette will get pushed wide. I hope I'm wrong, though. You know, so hopefully we'll see when we play Everton. But Sean, what would you expect to see versus what would you hope to see?
What would I expect to see? Possibly Lacazette riding the pine a little bit. What would I hope to see? Him on the field. You've got, you know, this Arsenal franchise, broke its record for buying a player when they bought Lacazette, and then just did it again when they bought Aubameyang. And it's like, I hope to see that your two most expensive players on the field contributing to the game itself, whether, you know, they can slightly modify their attacking formation that will somehow still help Lacazette and not hinder him. So I'd hope that he can be on the field and not feel like, you know, why did I come to Arsenal? Why did I sign here? If I'm going to be sitting the bench now, obviously I'm making a lot of money, but you know, the guy wants to play. He's a player. He deserves to be on the pitch. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, Arsene can find a successful formation to hopefully play these two like very top talents.
And it's interesting because it's a World Cup year too. So you know Lacazette's going to want to get on the pitch. This, you know, this spring more than anything, he wants to get on the field and get his, you know, get himself in the eyes of the French manager, because obviously there's a lot of competition for that place.
Yeah, I mean, kind of what you guys, what Alex, what you said about what you expect to see. Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. I do think that Arsene is going to, he's probably going to slide Lacazette out wide. But, you know, and I think I touched on it on the last pod. There was, I forget which game it was, where we were still playing three at the back. And I think it still remains to be seen what Arsene does there. I know he's kind of shown a couple of games recently where he has put four in the back. So I don't know what he really wants to stick to as far as that is concerned, but that's going to make a big difference. I mean, if he's content with three at the back, I mean, you're going to see something along the lines of the same 3-4-1-2, like the Christmas tree shape. Well, not quite, because the top's inverted. With Mesut Ozil dropping into the 10, and I think you'd see Mkhitaryan either probably pushed out to an attacking-minded wingback, which is not really where I want to see him. I want to see him further up the pitch. So this, your suggestion of the 4-2-2-2, so you do have, it's a 4-4-2, but your wide attacking midfielders are more narrow. I think that suits our squad the best. That puts players in the best position. I mean, I like Elneny as one of those holding spots. I mean, right now I would pick Elneny and Jack because of the form Jacques has shown recently. Mm-hmm. But I forget who said it on Twitter that if you're worried about width, well, we have Hector Bellerin and Nacho Monreal, so we don't really have to worry about those guys getting forward and providing width because they do that more than they defend most games. So, you know, I think the width problem with playing that narrow 4-4-2, if you want to call it that, is really compensated well for by your outside backs. Now, the big issue there is your holding central midfielders have to be responsible. And for the last, I don't even know how many years, probably since Mikel Arteta, we've shown that we haven't had central midfielders that could play that defensive spot responsibly. So would that formation really work with the personnel that we have? I don't know. Does it get our best four players on the field in positions that suit them? Yeah, I think it does. So that's why I say we do it, because like I said, they're our best four players.
Yep.
Yeah, and truthfully, we have such a tough time defending anyways. Yeah. You know, we were kind of joking off air, but let's just kind of go all out attack, you know, just...
I wasn't joking. I know it sounded like I was, but I was dead serious on that, man.
I mean, there's something to it because, look, we're always going to spring goals at the back with this manager. That's just the reality. We don't know how to defend. We don't have a clear defensive system. It is what it is. Why not make it fun? Why not just say, hey, you know what? We're going to give up three goals. We're going to score four. We're going to score five. And with that formation, at least you're putting these guys in a position, like you said, Ian, to do what they do best. And that's create and that's score. And the interchanging of movement that you could get from those four guys, especially when, you know, Ozil already has an understanding with Lacazette. Mkhitaryan has an understanding with Aubameyang. And they're all smart players, so they can pick it up pretty quickly. And actually, Ian, you brought up the point about Lacazette's movement along the back line and kind of how he can move from side to side and draw the center backs and draw fullbacks in, and that would create that space for Aubameyang. And that's something I actually hadn't thought about, just with that lateral movement and how it could lead to that vertical movement. And that's something I'm excited to see. And I know Mesut is excited to see it, because I do think us signing Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang was a key factor in him renewing. And, you know, I'm not trying to get off topic, but it makes me wonder what exactly Mesut was told about future signings and, you know, kind of who's coming in, who the manager's going to be. You know, I don't know exactly what he's been told, but you don't sign a 3.5-year deal, which is your last big contract of your life, unless you were given some assurances, in my opinion.
Yeah, there had to have been some. And I mean, I don't think there's any way they could tell him who the manager was going to be next year unless it was Arsene Wenger, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the hell they told him, but whatever they told him, it worked. So he's ours, and if they lied to him to get it done, I don't know at this point in time, because he signed the contract and we've got him locked down. But, I mean, you're right, though. Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan coming in, you have to think that Ozil is going to enjoy playing with those players more than he enjoyed playing with Alexis. Not that he didn't enjoy playing with Alexis, because it seemed like those two only looked for each other out there. But when you have, I mean, you talk about the movement, man, they're all four of those players are so intelligent with their movement. And if you have somebody like Jack coming in behind them a little bit deeper, I mean, we may see the return of Wenger ball.
I feel like you've said that for a long time.
I have said that, but you know what? We have now added two players that could very easily that could play such a huge part in that coming back. Mm-hmm. Another creative player in Mkhitaryan, and a finisher in Aubameyang, and Jack Wilshere getting healthier. I mean, the second Jack got back into the team, you started seeing more of those combination passes, driving midfield runs. I mean,
you also saw our record get worse.
You also saw Xhaka play like crap and check pass the ball to Swansea attackers. So I'm not going to put it all on Jack.
Here's a question I have. I know that we've been weak on the defense, and we're hopefully that is going to be something that is addressed in the summer. I apologize if you guys have talked about this before, but what's going on with Kolasinac? Is like Banger not like his style of play? Because I mean, he's a left back or has played left back for a very long time, and he is not being put in the left back or even being put on the field. Is he nagging injury that just, you know, keeps him off the field, or it's just like Wenger is just not that impressed with him?
I think there's some issue there. I really do. I think, I don't know if he was brought in solely to be a left wing back as opposed to a left back. And now that we've had to move to this four at the back in recent games, maybe Wenger doesn't see him as a viable option there. But now, even when we've had the opportunity to bring him back after his injury, you've seen us put Monreal out there. So I think it's a really good question, actually. And that was kind of something I was thinking about today. It seems like Kolasinac has kind of fallen out of favor, and I can't quite figure out why, because when he's played well. You know, he's never been a weak spot in the defense, in my opinion. His positioning is good. You know, I mean, obviously there's some adjustments moving to a new league. I think that goes without saying, but I mean, you've seen Maitland-Niles put out there as well. You know, even when we played with the three, you know, with the three at the back and the two wing backs. So I've got, I was telling someone earlier, I've got this sneaking suspicion that if Wenger is the manager next season, Kolasinac won't be here next season. I don't know. Ian, what do you think?
I don't know if I would quite go that far, because I know part of when we started seeing Maitland-Niles get run at that left wing back spot, Kolasinac was definitely dealing with an injury. I believe he was out of the team and he was injured for a while there. So I don't know necessarily, like, I mean, the point you made about when we shifted back to the four in the back and how he may not see him as a left back, I mean, I could certainly see that. But I don't know. I don't want to assume that there was a falling out or Wenger has completely lost trust in the player. I mean, he was the best player on the field for us for the first month and a half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that, you know, giving up on a player after a couple of months isn't necessarily an Arsene Wenger thing, though.
Lucas Perez.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
All right, okay.
So literally just happened last season.
That's true. But, I mean, was Lucas Perez ever – I don't know that he was ever shown the trust that Kolasinac was shown from the get-go. I mean, I think, you know, from the moment Kolasinac got here, he was a staple at that left wing back. I mean, Perez was never really a first choice player for us. He played in some cup games, he played in some Champions League games, and always did well. But I don't know that Wenger ever showed the trust in him to be able to say that he lost the trust, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, maybe the comparison is different because, you know, Perez was not a panic buy, but he was kind of a last minute thing. You know, Kolasinac was a player we signed early in the summer, but I mean, I really do think he was bought with this idea that we were going to stick with the three at the back, because at Schalke, he did play as a left wing back, but he also played as a left back, and he was in the Bundesliga team in the season as a left back. So it is confusing. I mean, we'll see what happens on Sunday. I mean, Saturday, sorry. Nothing's happening on Sunday. We don't play then. But Saturday, when we play Everton, you know, we'll see who starts that game. If it's Monreal, it's a little concerning because, you know, Monreal's not exactly young, and to play two games in less than a week when we have a healthy alternative would kind of, to me, tell me something about where Kolasinac stands at this point. But I don't know, Sean, what's kind of your feeling on Kolasinac? I know, you know, you'd mentioned that you were kind of wondering what happened to him. I mean, what was your first thought when you saw he was healthy and not necessarily being put back into the squad?
Possibly that, like, Maitland-Niles just really has impressed Wenger and has kind of, like, earned his spot on the pitch over him, as well as, like, Nacho Monreal, who's, like, playing out of his mind these days. And possibly, I don't know, he just keeps tinkering with that back line, whether it's, like, oh, I'm gonna have, you know, run three backs back there, or for certain games, like I think he was it in the Chelsea game, he was running four and then he kind of switched to a three at some point, or the other way around. I know
this he had like Elneny in midfield and then Elneny kind of dipped back into center back spot.
And so I don't know if he's just he's still tinkering with that, and you know, maybe this is all nothing. Maybe Kolasinac is still, maybe something's still nagging him that Wenger can see that in training, and it just is smart enough to continue to give him ample rest. Or like you said, maybe this is this season's Lucas Perez. I guess we'll find out, you know, as the season goes on and into the summer.
You know, I'd like to think that it was Maitland Niles pushing Kolasinac kind of out of the side, because that's a great sign, because Maitland Niles is going to be a very important player for us, I think, in the near future. But I don't know if that's what it was. It's so hard to tell with Arsene sometimes. So
I mean, my thing with Arsene has always been, I don't feel like he goes out with a plan. I feel like he's just, you know, he just tries things. And then if it works, he'll just stick with it. But he doesn't really say, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to implement it, and we're going to stick with this. And if the personnel don't fit, we're going to put someone else in. You know, the three at the back thing was kind of an accident last season. I mean, it just kind of came as a desperate reaction to a bad stretch run. It wasn't something that we necessarily had been working on. It was just something that we got a result, and it, you know, didn't really alter how many chances we were giving up either, which was the interesting thing. We, you know, teams were just not converting as well. So I, again, this sounds so cynical to say, but sometimes I feel like when we find something good, it's mostly because Wenger stumbled onto it by accident more than an actual coherent plan.
I don't know. I mean, I gotta be honest. I hate that argument.
I thought he was playing back because of Chelsea.
I mean, look, I'm all on the side of Arsene Wenger's got to go. His time's up. He hasn't adjusted with the times. Whatever. You've heard my opinions on it. But are we seriously going to sit here and say that he gets lucky, or that he did it because Chelsea did it?
Yes.
We were in a terrible run of form, and you know what? Like, what are the things that we always say when we're in a terrible run of form and he doesn't change something? You know, and that can come down to the fact that he trusts his players too much. Fine, I'll give you that. He certainly does put too much on his players to make the changes themselves. There's no doubt about that. But when we're going through a rough run of form and he changes the entire formation, we can't say that's lucky. It's not like he accidentally put three center backs on the field and they accidentally lined the guys up in a 3-5-2 and said, oh, I filled the team sheet out wrong today. Look, it worked. That's an accident, right? So, and you can't tell me that he never thought of a three-back system before Chelsea did it. Three-back systems have been around forever.
Yeah, but he'd never played one up until then.
Okay, because he never really had to.
Maybe if you've looked at our defensive record for the past 5 or 6 years, I would say there were ample opportunities to play.
Yeah, I mean, sure. You can certainly say that there are opportunities to try something different. I'm not going to put that and say that he copied Chelsea or got lucky. Now, your point about it didn't change how we played defensively, the teams just stopped converting at the rate they were before. Yeah, you're right. I don't think we played any better defensively on the switch. And I'm not saying that the three-back system is what we should be playing. Quite frankly, I don't like it. Not with the wing-backs that we have.
I'll use a contrast, just kind of a comparison. If you look at Allegri at Juventus, right, they play three at the back or four at the back based on who they're playing. They don't necessarily play it based on recent results. And I think maybe that's where kind of our disagreement is. I think Wenger just does things until they don't work anymore. I don't think he's proactive in making changes ahead of time.
Right. I think that's a different argument though. I think it's a different discussion.
But like, I think, you know, with the three at the back, when we did it last season, you know, he all of a sudden Rob Holding hadn't played like all season and he shoves him in
And that's how we started playing it. And then for this season, the three at the back started leaking those goals, and then we shift back to four at the back. You know, it's always reactive. So, well, if, I mean, it's oh, maybe I shouldn't say he stumbles onto it, but I just feel like he'll try different. Exactly. He'll try different things, but it's never like, all right, hey, look, we're playing City today, so let's actually go with the 4-3-3 and play two holding mids and then one, you know, box to box. You know, he doesn't think like that, but that's not necessarily what I see on the field. And I didn't mean to cut you guys off there.
No, he doesn't change his tactics based on who he's playing. And that's a major problem. Mm-hmm. There's no denying that fact. My only thing is that the fact that he gets, you know, when Conte goes to three at the back, oh, Conte, he's a genius. But when Wenger does it, he's copying Conte. I just think that's such a lazy excuse. I do. And yes, you know, did changes need to be made in the last couple of years because their defensive record has been brutal? Yes. There's no doubt about that. And I think that, you know, the point you made about when he finds something that works, he sticks to it. It just does the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah, absolutely. And that's certainly something that can be held against him. There's no doubt. I mean, he needs, you know, and the fact that I don't remember if he started with four at the back against Chelsea or if he shifted to it, whichever it was. The fact that we've had so much success against them with three at the back recently and that we didn't use the same tactics, that's an issue. Right, there's no doubt about that. I have such a problem with that. He got lucky with a three back, or he only did it because I just have such a problem with that. I didn't mean to completely derail the podcast into
I'll throw this to Sean too. But like, I mean, again, maybe lucky is the wrong term, but when you kind of try something as a last resort and it ends up kind of papering over the cracks. Yeah. I'm not sure you can call that great management. You know what I mean? If you play four at the back and you give up 10 great chances and the team scores three of them, and you play three at the back and you give up those same 10 chances and the team only scores two of them, you're not doing anything better. There's nothing that you've changed that necessarily has improved the team. You're privy to the conversion of another team. And so, you know, Sean, I mean, you kind of went after your Chelsea take hard there, so I'm going to let you defend yourself.
I mean, it's fine. I mean, I thought it was a little lucky. I mean, look at when his formation that he threw out for the FA Cup final last year. I mean, he put Mertesacker in the starting squad, and I think everybody was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then Mertesacker had like the game of his life, and you know, if that's the last game he ever plays, that's, you know, such a way to go out like that. And it just seemed to work. It was definitely a gamble. But I, you know, maybe I don't know if he relatively game planned or he just wanted to go with the players that he trusted the most for like that game. And that's what he consistently does. That's kind of what Ian is talking, you know, getting to. He has this knack for like overly trusting a lot of his players and not wanting to adjust to the opponents that he's coming up on. Cause you know, not every team in the Premier League plays the same way. You have to adjust to the team that you're facing. That's, you know, the way we're playing happens to, you know, work well with Chelsea. And that's why we've been kind of, you know, we've had their number for a little bit. You know, but then we can, you know, we'll go to Swansea and drop a game that we're not supposed to. It's like, what's going on here? Why aren't the adjustments being made? Why, you know, you shouldn't be losing, you know, this many away games this season. I mean, I think we're lucky with our home record to be in the sixth position right now. We could be in a better position had we, you know, actually won more than what, two away games possibly. We've lost like 12 or more.
Yeah, we've only won three away games all season.
I mean, just to kind of put this whole thing to rest, the for now at least, Wenger Wenger really is a dinosaur when it comes to managers. When you look at somebody like Claudio Ranieri, for example, he was nicknamed the Tinker Man because he couldn't stop messing with his team. He couldn't stop changing his formations, couldn't stop changing his team. Mm-hmm. But he did that at a time when managers just didn't do that. I mean, when Arsene Wenger and Arsenal were at their peak, it was, this is your first 11, you roll them out every game unless somebody's hurt. That's the way it was. You put the same formation and you would roll it out and go and go and go. The game has changed and Arsene hasn't adapted with that. I mean, like I said, there's no denying that fact, but I just want to put that out there that like when you look at Ranieri, for example, like I said, he came at the time that he was messing with teams. That was when other managers didn't, and he got criticized for it. So it's
Arsene. He came in during his time. He was very innovative for that early, you know, time when he took over the team. He also had a team that was like stacked with talent,
right?
You know, the Invincibles and whatnot. And he was able to win a lot. And, you know, we love the man for it. And he's going to end up with a bronze statue outside of the Emirates for it as well. It's just that, like you said, he's a dinosaur and it's just, he hasn't evolved with the changing times. He was definitely somebody new to the scene back in the 90s with his, you know, the way he was running the team. But nowadays it's like everybody's caught up to him. And that's why we all feel like, you know, it's time to move on from Wenger because, you know.
Yep. I agree. It is time to move on from there. But after, now that I took that, took this podcast from transfers into something completely different. Just, I don't know how the heck that happened. Just wasted the last 15 minutes of everybody's lives. Before we get out of here, I want to jump back into the transfers just a little bit. There was a lot of other really big moves that happened in the Premier League in the last, you know, this month alone, whether they're players coming into the Premier League or moving out. Just kind of quick little rundown. Virgil van Dijk to Liverpool, Ross Barkley to Chelsea, Philippe Coutinho to Barcelona for £106 million.
Ooh.
Insane. That number is mind-blowing. He should have gone for about maybe 60, in my opinion. Aymeric Laporte to City for almost £60 million. Their defense alone is more expensive than Arsenal is right now. Lucas Moura to Spurs. And for those of you that really care, Andre Ayew back to Swansea. So, Alex, I'm going to send it over to you first. Who do you see that comes out as the big winner? Real, let's kind of keep it short. Your winner for this transfer window.
I mean, I'm really, given all the circumstances, it's hard not to say Arsenal didn't come out a winner. I think, Given what could have been, Arsenal definitely came out a winner. I think City came out a winner just by signing another young defender. And this is a guy that can really bed it into Guardiola's system with not much pressure, though, you know, because they have other defenders there. You know, they have guys that can kind of ease him in. In terms of losers, I don't want to say Liverpool is a loser, but I don't think Virgil van Dijk is worth $75 million. And, you know, I get that they, you know, they got the money for Coutinho and that, you know, it was always going to kind of work in that way. But, you know, losing Coutinho is a big blow for them. And, you know, obviously they got Keita coming in the summer. But, you know, I don't think they improved their squad. I think Everton did some pretty good business. You know, I think Theo Walcott really fits their system. They brought in Mangala from City on loan today. They brought Sang Tosin from Besiktas. So I think, you know, given where they are, that's probably about as good as they could have expected. I don't get some of Chelsea's business, to be honest. I don't get the Ross Barkley signing. I mean, what am I missing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to put them down as the losers for me in this window. It was strange. Even the rumors earlier in the window, they were linked with Andy Carroll, Peter Crouch, like Then they ended up with Olivier Giroud and sent Batshuayi to Dortmund on loan for whatever reason. And I don't understand it. When you look at the other players they have on their team, they really, really wanted a target striker. And it doesn't make sense what they were doing. Them and really, like you said, Liverpool, it's really hard to argue that they're not a loser. Also, I mean, they've been after Van Dijk for a year now, and they finally got him, 75 million. I would rather have Aymeric Laporte all day. Right now, Van Dijk maybe is probably the superior player by just a little bit, but a year and a half from now, I mean, it's not going to be any competition. I think Laporte's going to be by far the better defender. I think he's by far the more technical player, which in the Premier League, I think is a very big thing. But to be fair, I think Liverpool got the bargain of the window in 106 million for Philippe Coutinho from Barcelona. So it's hard to really put them too far down the list as a loser. And a winner, City always does good business. Everton had a good window. I mean, City, it looked like they were going to land, Riyad Mahrez from Leicester up until the very end, and then something kind of fell through there. I think it had something to do with City lowballing Leicester and not getting criticized for it. If that was Arsenal, we would never hear the end of it. But yeah, winners, it's hard to argue that we weren't the big winner, especially if you want to include Mesut Ozil in our transfer window. So
yeah, what about you, Sean? What are you thinking, winners and losers from this window?
I'll be biased. I'm gonna say Arsenal.
You're allowed to be biased.
Okay. Arsenal grabbed the headlines and they actually delivered. You know, we were talked about for over a week. It was the high profile striker. We actually got him. We signed him. We came out looking a lot better than we did with the Alexis situation because of the fact that we didn't just let him go for free. You know, we actually made a deal with Man United and got a player out of it, you know, a really good player, and who could hopefully be great when paired back with with Aubameyang, a player that he used to play with and perform with. I think winners, you know, Mkhitaryan, because he gets away from Marino. losers, I'd say, you know, Liverpool.
Tottenham, just because they're Tottenham.
Yeah, Tottenham, because they're Tottenham. I don't know, Tottenham didn't look like they were losers today.
Yeah, I mean, Moura could be a good signing for him. He's always been Lucas, whatever he goes by. He's always been disappointing to me, but sorry. Continue as I just hijacked your point.
I was keeping it short anyways. I want to say hopeful losers would be Alexis Sanchez, and that, you know, that he goes to Man United and they don't ever win anything.
You a little bitter there, Sean?
Mourinho gets sacked. A little bit. I mean, I do have his kit at, you know, hanging up at work. Obviously, I don't turn it around these days. I just have the front of it showing, so...
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it's a fitting place for him to be.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, I really hope that anybody who's started this podcast is still with us as we get at the end of it. Went a little bit longer than expected, but hey, we always go a little bit longer than we expect. But this time, it's for the most part, was a very positive Euro Snob pod for you. Arsenal finally had a good window. They moved out a lot of the players that we've been saying for a year or two now needed to get moved out. And they really brought in some excellent players and locked down Mesut Ozil. I mean, if you told me that nothing else was going to change, but we signed Mesut Ozil to an extension in this window, I would tell you that this window was a success. And we went far and above just doing that. So there's no complaints on our transfer window on my end. And I assume there's no complaints on either of your ends either.
I'm with you there.
So I mean, has anybody got any last words that they want to kind of send us out on here?
I plan to order my Mesut Ozil jersey at least in March.
So. Hey, my birthday is coming up in like a week and a half. If you want to send one my way, I'll be more than grateful.
I tell you what, that make it that Aubameyang jersey, that Aubameyang 14 is looking real good right now. So
I couldn't rock a 14 if it wasn't Thierry Henry, man.
I'm thinking about it because I've wanted him at my club for so long. So I'm excited for that. But at the very least, some positive feelings around the club. That's really all you can ask for at this point, given what happened yesterday. Obviously, things are looking good today. I'm assuming the club will release the Ozil confirmation tomorrow. But I mean, let's face it, the club doesn't need to release it if Orenstein did, because I trust him more. I trust him more than the club. But yeah. But I'm going to throw it out for the usual Twitter shout outs. Sean, how can the people find you on Twitter if they want to direct any negative feedback?
Yeah,
all the negative goes to Sean, guys.
Yes,
that's,
please.
That's fine. Give me all the criticism. You can find me at Seanicus17. That's Seanicus17, and the name across that is Sean Fredtown Stomper.
And just for people that don't know, Fredtown Stomper, Sean, just real quick, kind of give everybody a heads up. Let them know what you got going on over there.
Oh, yeah. Fredtown Stomper is a moniker for my band, the Fredtown Stompers, that we play a lot of old 20s, 30s jazz with a very high-paced, you know, modern swing in your face kind of. I've been told we're more of like a punk New Orleans Dixieland. So, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but yeah, I really enjoy playing music.
So, yeah, basically, guys, if you've got a little bit of time and you're just looking to throw some good music on and listen to it and just kind of jam out for a little bit, go check them out. I mean, you guys have, you know, where can people find your music, Sean?
Well, you can find a lot of our performances on YouTube. We do actually have a CD. We don't have an online website platform in order to get that out just yet. But I guess if you're interested, feel free to drop me a message, a DM, and I'd be happy to hook you up with one.
All right. It's some cool stuff. And Alex, why don't you run down the rest of the Twitter and Facebook locations for us here?
Yeah, you can find myself at UFGoonerAJ. You can find Ian at GunnersFan6. Find the podcast at EuroSnobPod, Facebook.com/EuroSnobPod. Subscribe on iTunes, EuroSnob Podcast. Just search us there and you'll find us. You can also find us on the Podomatic site. But yeah, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I mean, that's really the best way to get updates on what we're doing. You certainly, if you have any feedback on stuff you want us to talk about, we'd be happy to hear it, unless it's negative, in which case don't direct it to me, cause I'm not going to read it. So
that's right. You can send it to me and I'll read it, but I won't reply.
Exactly. Cause I'm sensitive and I don't want people telling me how much I suck. So just don't do that. But in all seriousness, anytime you guys have stuff you'd like us to discuss, not just with the Arsenal stuff, but the U.S. soccer stuff, Lord knows there's enough there. And I know we'll probably get on with the next couple of weeks with the presidential election coming up really, really soon. So obviously keep an eye on that. We're going to keep abreast of what's going on. And so that's really it on the social media stuff.
Yeah. And like Alex said, definitely look for a pretty big U.S. soccer podcast to drop after that election comes out, because there's going to be a lot to go through, whether it's positive, negative. We'll be here and we'll break it all down for you. So like you said, keep your eyes out, keep your eyes and ears open to check that out when it does come out, because I'm sure that will happen. I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.